you got run twice.
Oh, okay.
So that's why you had to go.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Cool.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
That's why.
Oh my gosh.
See, I was thinking of taking corporations before I had these cases today, but then I was like, ow, I really need to take that class because this is like.
They were so dense,
that's
yeah.
That's how I felt too.
I had the exact same thoughts, like reading them. I had to read them like 4 and 5 times over, and then.
Are you taking corporations?
Next semester? No, but I plan on taking it. Probably my third year, first semester.
I said, look at you scheming.
I know. I'm like, are you planning on
doing that? That's right. You're trying to get someone to drive. Okay, yeah, there's an ulterior motive. I get it.
Am I, like, I'm probably bringing, like, some ethical rules and whatever kind of ethical code. It's okay. Now, but, you know, I got on the wait list for one class in Catholic. I was, like, number 13 and actually got it.
Oh, really?
So, I think
you just email the registrar?
Yeah. And actually, the reason why I was number 13 is because I think it was Washington's family law class. The reason why I was number 13 is because I didn't email them to weeks after registration began.
Yeah.
And, you know, they said, oh, we can add you, but, you know, you're number 13. And actually, they emailed me whenever I came on, but they emailed me and they're like, oh, you're up on the list. You want to spread the school?
Wow, that's pretty awesome.
So that was for summer, right?
That was for summer, yeah.
It filled up.
Everybody wanted to take Washington's family law course. Everybody.
Here I am in family law. Although I wouldn't trade it. Of course it's great.
I can tell you, you know, your final one is different, but for our final, right. We had.
We can start getting some feedback questions. Jared asked if you would have your papers back, your grades before the final. Definitely yes. The goal is to have it back to you a week from today so that you'll see I write a lot of comments. What'll happen is that. Thank you.
Is it still just running?
Yes.
I'll write comments on your paper. I will post what are called general comments on the website, which are things that sort of are applicable to a number of people, and I may just, in the paper, say, see general comment 3. And then I will post at least 2 of the best papers, and I'll try to pick papers that take significantly different approaches, so you can sort of see that by way of comparison. And then I'm happy, as I mentioned to Sharon, I'm happy to talk to people, set up time for office hours to talk about the papers, not to negotiate regrading, because we're not allowed to do that, but certainly to answer questions you may have, or just to generally talk about what I hope you may still think is an interesting topic. So, first of all, just mechanical questions about how this system would work. Anybody? Or is it reasonably clear? No questions? Yeah.
Okay, so just make sure I understand. You can't give everybody in your group a 1. The max that you can give for the entire is 2.5. So you divvy that up as you see fit.
Each person does.
Right.
And if somebody hands out more than 2.5, you'll get an email from me that says you're going to have to redo it.
Okay. Right. But you could potentially give everybody a 0.5. And have points left over that somebody would not need.
That's right. And conceivably, you guys are all really smart. I suppose you all could get together and conspire to give everybody 0.5 so that nobody's quiz score is affected. And if that happens, that happens. but other than that, if your firm decides among yourselves, we all did equally well, we all get 0.5, you take the risk that there will be another firm that comes to a different decision. There may be some sense, and I would appreciate this, that you say, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. If we all did equally good work, we were perfect team members, but there's some other place that's more dysfunctional, and that's going to give zeros and ones. That's a possibility. I don't think it's a huge possibility. I think the likelihood in a group of 5 that one person has done, has contributed more or less than the other 4 is enough that it'll be recognized. Notice that unless there is this broad consensus, and remember, you could take a look at what's on the website. You know, the numbers are adding up for the quiz scores. So this is going to be a marginal effect at best. The main reason I would say for doing this is to, number one, give you an incentive to spend some time evaluating and giving feedback to the other people in your firm. That's the main educational value of this exercise. And, you know, it's toward the end of the semester. If there's not some kind of rational incentive, then you've got other things you're going to do between now and getting ready for exam. The second is to recognize, as we talked about at the beginning of the semester, particularly the free rider problem. I hope it's not the case that there's somebody in the class who just hasn't prepared, and just kind of shows up and, you know, takes advantage of what they can get out of the firm without contributing something back. But if that's happening, there ought to be some mechanism for that. And I've allowed you, since early in the semester, to pick your own people, and I will do that again today. But you should think about if you are constantly leaning on the same person to represent your firm and filing appeals. Today, I'm going to pick somebody to take the lead on the OPM exercise. Then perhaps that person should get a little bit more of a bonus point than somebody else. So I'll let you guys work that out. Any other questions? Okay, well, as I say, last year, I thought I had a fair system worked out. I still thought it was a pretty fair system, but it was clear that a lot of people felt, even though the marginal effect on the final grade was small, they felt that it was an unfair system. And I think that was useful from a pedagogical standpoint, do something that a significant group of people genuinely thought was unfair to them because of the size of their group. So I'm open to feedback by next Monday, and then I'll think about modifying it. People have good points. Otherwise, we'll go ahead with that. Okay? All right. How many people, before they did the readings for this course, had heard of Clarence Darrow? Put up your hand. Well, you know, you have elbows. Put them all the way up. Lots of you hadn't. How many had not then? Let me just see. Okay. I've been teaching this course for a while. And when I first started teaching the course, I actually had more material from Clarence Darrow's work than I do now. But I quite naively assumed that I didn't have to explain to anybody who Clarence Darrow was. How many people have heard of Albert Einstein? Everybody? Okay. And not only do you recognize the name, but I think Einstein is kind of a synonym for a genius, right? So you could say, she's smart, but she's no Einstein. And that would make sense to people. Well, even though Darrow had died long before I went to law school, yes, that's true. When I went to law school, just like you could say, well, she's smart, but she's no Einstein, you could say, well, she's a good lawyer, but she's no Clarence Darrow. That's what Clarence Darrow meant in law. Clarence Darrow was the paradigm of the best trial lawyer in American history, the way Einstein is a paradigm of sort of the scientific genius. You might not agree or disagree with that, but one thing that's striking is the number of movies that have been made about Clarence Darrow, either actual or fictionalized, and the number of famous actors. Of course, some of these actors won't mean anything to you either, but the number of famous actors who have played Clarence Darrow, Orson Welles, you're about to see Henry Fonda, George C. Scott, the list goes, you know, it's quite a long list of people who played him. But what we're going to talk about today is an early time in Darrow's life that's generally not much known about. And so what I thought I'd do is, what I'm going to show you is that Henry Fonda did a one-person show of Clarence Darrow, which is very well done. And I'm just going to show you a couple of little clips from it, like I have with the others, to sort of, even though it's not the actual person, with Frank Armitage, you got to see the actual person, for better or worse. But here, at least, you get a flavor of Clarence Darrow. In connection with the readings for today, which is the difficult decisions he made while working as general attorney for a railroad in Chicago when this huge historic railroad strike began. So let's take a look at this. And yes, there's going to be a quiz question after you watch this that was not assigned in advance. So it's worth watching.
For 50 years, in courtrooms all over America, Clarence Darrow helped shape the conscience of a nation.
Three were sentenced to long terms, and the people of Chicago pronounced themselves satisfied. Still, Chicago was an extraordinary place. It was life and excitement for me. New people and ideas, good talks and debates, and good friends, like the great John Peter Alkell, who helped me get a job with the city as special assessments attorney. I didn't know what it meant either, except that it meant $60 a week. I worked 4 years for the city of Chicago. I went up against the railroads quite a few times on right-of-way litigations and generally managed to lick them. So one day, the Chicago Northwestern came to me and offered me a good job as their general attorney. Frankly, I wasn't sure my thoughts on life didn't equip me for that sort of work, but Alkell thought I should take it. Finally, I did. It helped us buy a nice house on the north side where I hoped Jesse would be happy. He wasn't really. Big city, new friends, new ideas. She felt it wasn't what she bargained for, and of course it wasn't.
Whoops.
She grew not to like to do things. Did you have a nice day, Jesse? Did you get out of the house? It was beautiful down by the lake. I worry about you cooped up in the house with Paul all day long. You could take him into the park in his carriage. No, of course you don't, if you don't want to. You It wasn't all one-sided, of course. It never is. I worked 2 years for the Chicago Northwestern. Then in 1894, Eugene V. Debs took his railway union out in support of the Pullman strikers and struck every railroad in the country, including the one I was working for, and I had to choose sides. George Pullman, the sleeping car man, had built a brand new town out of 500 acres of Illinois prairie to house his workers. It was an extraordinary place. This is how he described it. Bright beds of flowers and green velvety stretches of lawn, dotted with parks and pretty water vistas, homes filled with light, a town where all that inspires to cleanliness of person and of thought is generously provided. I almost bought a home there myself. There's only one small thing I couldn't understand, how anyone living in this paradise, this Garden of Eden, would ever want to go on strike. I thought I'd better go down and look around. The main street was a vision. Bright red flower beds, groves of tall green trees lining the walks, houses of neat red brick with trim lawns in front. Lovely. Only, and this was curious, just one street back of the main street where the workers lived, the houses didn't have lawns. They didn't have windows. They had at most one faucet for cold water, and that was in the basement where it was cheapest to run the pipes in. Three, four, five families crowded into each tenement, all using one toilet. And the entire town where everything that inspires to cleanliness of person is generously provided. Not one bathtub. I talked to some of the people who lived there. At least I tried to. They were afraid to talk. Every move they made was watched. Everything they said was reported back to the company. If a man talked of joining a union, he was fired that day, his family thrown out of their house, his name was put on a blacklist and sent to every railroad in the country. And the wages, 1894, brought hard times. Skilled men who earned $3.20 a day saw their wages cut until, after Pullman took out the rent money, all they had left to feed their families on was 4 cents a week. But the price of food in the Pullman Company store where the wives had to buy had stayed the same. 43 men asked permission to come in and tell Mr. Pullman their families were starving to death. They asked for and were given a firm promise they wouldn't be discharged if they came into talk. Mr. Pullman listened to the 43 men, said there was nothing to discuss, that his only responsibility was to his stockholders, and there was no reason to give the workers a gift of money. And the next day, fired them all and put their families out on the street. That's when the Pullman strike started, and Gene Debs called out his railway workers in support. Of course, it didn't take our government any time at all to choose sides. They got an injunction making it one crime for a man to go on strike and another for one man to suggest for another to even consider going on strike.
Okay, just to be clear, Pullman is not the president of the railroad that Darrow works for. Okay, Pullman, you know, was related to the railroad industry. And so when his employees went on strike against Pullman, the General Union of Railway Workers, led by Eugene Debs, did a sympathy strike and struck all the railroads, including the one that Darrow worked for. Okay? So the question. Now I'm going to give you a little time on this. Obviously, the question draws on the readings you did for today. The movie was just kind of a refresher. People see down here. It's a little bit hard. Hang on a second. Does that help? I'd encourage you to be looking at 1.7 as you answer this question, whether whether it's in the hard copy or electronic copy. The timer's going to kick in fairly soon. And starting the timer. Okay, I'll pull up the response grid. Somebody not working? Spencer's not here. Yep. Still not working? Still, is it working? Kara's not working either. All right, so we're set. Thought it was Chris. Sorry about that, Jerry. But at least it's your. Okay, so 28% say A. Nobody says B. 21% C. 52% D. So I'll let you. Talk in the firms again, and we'll vote one more time. Mm-hmm. as you talk, you're going to have two managing partners today. The managing partner for quizzes, so pick that person. There'll be a managing, and then the other is going to be your, not your managing partner, but your advocate, your representative for the OPM exercise. So pick your managing partner for the quizzes. That person should check to, after you vote, to check to see if your firm was unanimous or not. When we come around to the OPM exercise, that person is going to be the person I call on from your firm to participate in that exercise. That gives an incentive to be the managing partner, right? Okay, I think it's probably time to vote. Okay, I'm hitting the countdown timer, folks. Well, we can't do both at the same time, guys. Carson? Okay. Interesting. Okay. There's a reasonably good chance there's a firm where everybody picked D, so quickly check to see if your firm, and you might have been unanimous on A. Nobody was unanimous on B and C. Do a quick check. Manager partner, put up your hand if your firm is unanimous. Okay, Willie. What was your firm unanimous with?
D.
And why?
Well, first, Annette and I thought it would be A because the way that the rule was written, it says that's confirmed in writing after. Fall under that, but Brett, Jacob, and Corey explained that it said which of these by itself would be permissible, and it explained that one of the comments, I think it's comment A, you can basically limit your scope to that which doesn't adversely affect the client, and so D would be the right answer.
That's exactly the right analysis. Okay. So, the threshold question under 1.7 is there a significant risk that there would be, that one of these various interests, the lawyer's own interests, and that was the case here, Darrow had strong personal feelings of sympathy for the strikers. He wanted them to succeed, which was, I think, why I wanted to show you the video, just to bring that to life. He really, when he took the job at the railroad, he recognized that he wondered about his personal values might run up against his responsibilities for the company, but they did not, he felt, until the strike happened. And he talked in the what you read for today about, you know, yes, he was inclined to have the railroad compensate people who had claims, but the claims agent would agree with him. So there was not a conflict between his personal feelings and what the company was deciding to do. But now there was. He wanted He wanted the strikers to succeed, and yet the railroad wanted to put him as its representative on the strike committee that was managing the response to try to suppress the strike through seeking an injunction and other means. There also could be a risk that the lawyer's duties to another client, who you have right now, the duties to a former client, or to a third person, any of those interests could materially and adversely affect the representation of the client. You'll notice that although the name of the rule is conflict of interest, the phrase conflict of interest is not used in the body of the rule. And there's a reason for that, because people talk, get kind of tangled up about whether the rule requires that there be a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest. You'll hear lawyers talk about a potential conflict versus an actual conflict. If what is meant by a conflict of interest is that, in fact, the representation of the client is adversely affected, well, then you violated a whole bunch of other rules too, right? The duty, you know, seeking the client's objectives, communication, whatever, right? If you're not representing the person, client, well, you've already probably run afoul of some other rules. This is a precautionary rule, okay? And you could be disbarred for representing or continuing to represent a client even if there is no harm to the client, okay? The rule says what you have to do is think about, is there a significant risk? And if there's a significant risk, even if that risk never comes to pass, you can be disbarred and sued for malpractice and disqualified and all kinds of other things for representing that client, unless there's an exception that applies. Is that much clear to people? So what you've got to do is what Darrow did, is you've got to be constantly asking yourself, I'm representing two clients at the same time. Is there a possibility? Basically, the question is, am I representing this client differently because I also have a duty to another client, a duty to some third person, or because of my own interests? And if there's a chance that I'm going to be representing this client differently, I have to say, is that difference going to harm the representation in a way that's material? And so that was the scrutiny that Darrow was imposing on himself. And when he got to this point of the strike, he said, there is a significant risk. And he disclosed it to his client. And the client said, Clarence, thank you for telling us. We have such confidence in you. We believe you can continue to do a good job for us representing the railroad on the strike committee, even the way you feel. Okay? So that triggers the question of Section B. Because we're often talking about competing values, right? One is the value of loyalty. Clients like that you owe a client a duty of confidentiality, you owe them a duty of loyalty. But countering that is clients ought to have some autonomy to choose their lawyers. And so within certain constraints, as long as the client is aware of it, understands the significant risk, they can choose to take that risk if all the conditions of B are met. And that's what seemed to be happening here in the strike situation. But meeting the standard of consent is very high. It's particularly high in Georgia. If you look at the comparison between Georgia 1.7 and the ABA model rule, it is harder to meet the informed consent standard in Georgia than it is in most states that follow the ABA model rule. What do you need to do? Well, it is not enough just to get the informed consent confirmed in writing, which is A. Even if the president says, I consent, before you can ask the client to give informed consent, okay, that has to be done after consultation, in which you explain the risk. But more importantly, you have to give the client in writing an explanation of the risks and reasonable available alternatives. This is distinctive to Georgia. The ABA model rule comments require consultation, and the comments say consultation, you should explain the risks and reasonably available alternatives. But Georgia requires that you do it in writing. And I can't tell you how often I have seen cases in Georgia where lawyers fall short and end up malpractice or disciplined or disqualified because they provided something in writing to the client that basically said there's no conflict. And if what they mean is there's no significant risk, then you don't need informed consent. But if there is a significant risk, you as the lawyer have to do something difficult, which Darrow did, but you have to do it in writing. You have to tell your client, here are a number of reasons why you should not have me as your lawyer anymore. And that is one hard letter to write. But if you don't put down in writing what the risks are, you haven't satisfied the rule. And if there are no risks, you don't need to do it. So you have to explain what the risks are. And you have to explain what the alternatives are, which typically would be getting another law firm involved, shifting to somebody else. Now, you are allowed to put in the cost and benefits. You can say, here are the risks, but we believe that in the face of these risks, we can still do a good job for you, and this is why we can. And here are what we think are the costs to you of terminating our representation, going to another firm, the cost of starting up over again, our expertise, the relationship, whatever. You're free to, in that statement, explain the pros, the positive parts of being retained, but you can't do it without explaining the risks. And you have to give the client the opportunity to consult with independent counsel. It does not require that they, in fact, do so. It doesn't even technically require that you have to tell them in writing. You have the opportunity, though you would be stupid not to put that in the letter. But what this does mean, and again, this is where so many Georgia lawyers mess up, is what they do is, it's typically called a waiver. You know, did you get a waiver letter? Oh, if you got a waiver letter, no problem. With the clients agreed, waive the conflict. That's the way a lot of people talk about it. And so what they'll do is they'll give the letter, which is the informed consent confirmed in writing. Sign it on the spot. Hand it to you. Maybe talk about it for a few minutes. They sign it on the spot. Why does that not comply with the rules? Anybody? Right. How could they possibly have talked to independent counsel if they signed it at the time you give it to them? But the majority of lawyers still in Georgia that I run into do it that way. It's got to be a two-step process. You have to give it to them in writing first. Let them think about it. Have a chance to get a second opinion, come back. But you don't necessarily have to meet with them again, but then after that they sign the letter. Next week, we're going to do an exercise where, based on the baby Jessica story in Volume 2. By the way, I've handed out one extra copy of Volume 2. Does anybody not have Volume 2? I asked you to check to make sure you did. Okay, good. And I'll have the specific assignment up by tomorrow. But what you're going to do in that case is reenact a meeting between Sue Ellen Skarnecchia, who is the lawyer who represents these adoptive parents in the famous baby Jessica case. And the question is, should she represent both the adoptive mother and the adoptive father? Or should they have separate counsel? Now, that's a good example where most lawyers would represent both the adoptive mother and adoptive father, because there are all kinds of reasons why you would have the same lawyer rather than separate lawyers. But as you prepare to do that exercise next week, there are some risks involved in having the same lawyer represent both parents. I'm not going to require you to do a writing assignment for next week where you actually write out what you would provide to, in this case, Jan DeBoer, the father, the adoptive father. But you would be wise to kind of at least sketch it out, because what I'm going to ask at least one of you to do, and I'm going to be the client next week, is to do the consultation, to explain to me the risks and reasonable alternatives to having, in this case, it's a law school clinic that's already met with his wife. And the wife has already said, I want the clinic to represent me. So that now the question is there informed consent to represent the husband as well by the same clinic? So this is what we're going to do is the consultation next week. And in the context of the consultation, you're going to give the information that would later be reduced to writing. Does that make sense? So it gives you practice doing that. Make sense? All right. So the problem with the quiz question is no one of these things by themselves is sufficient. You have to satisfy all three of these and this to have informed consent. So that's why at the last one, D is the right one. Neither A, B, or C can be correct because none of them by themselves are sufficient. And here, and this is what Darrow did, is he continued to work for the railroad for a while, but he said, I can't represent you on the strike committee. So he he got consent to narrow the scope of his representation, work on other things, and got himself out of that significant risk trigger point. Any questions about it? Okay, now, because we're running a little late, I won't show the next part of the video that shows the next part of the story, which is sort of remarkably, really. Eugene Debs is charged with contempt of court. They get an injunction to prohibit the strike, primarily on the grounds that the trains were carrying the U.S. mail, and so the United States came in and joined the unions in seeking to prohibit the strike because of the interest in moving the U.S. mail. Darrow suggests he thought it was actually something of a conspiracy between the government and the railroads to try to put mail on every single train, so be it. So they got an order against prohibiting the strike, and Debs and the union continued the strike. And so they arrested and charged with criminal contempt Debs. Debs comes to Darrow, of all people, and says, will you defend me on the criminal contempt charges? I don't really know. His biography doesn't say why, out of all the possible people, he went to somebody who was employed by one of the railroads to defend him. But all I can imagine is by this time, Darrow had become so well known. Remember, he had worked for the city before that, had been involved in progressive political, had probably spoken out about his views. Perhaps people knew that he had stepped away from the strike committee. I don't know why. But anyway, Debs went to Darrow and said, would you be my lawyer? At that point, quiet informed consent was not permissible. So this comes into play. It's probably not C2. C2 is sort of the obvious point that you can't represent, by the way, you can't represent husband and wife in the same divorce. Still occasionally happens in Georgia. They say, oh, it's an uncontested divorce that they've agreed with everything. They're still parties against each other. You can't represent that. You can't represent buyer and seller. And you can't represent even people on the same side. If you're representing co-defendants in a civil action and then one of the co-defendants wants to file a cross-claim against them, all of a sudden you're on both sides of the same claim. And then you have to step away. It's simply not something that consent can... that you can't even ask the client to give consent. And then C3 is a kind of a catch-all. If the representation involves circumstances rendering it reasonably unlikely that the lawyer will be able to provide adequate representation of one or more of the affected clients, and it seems impossible to imagine that he could be defending the president of the union against this criminal prosecution and still working for the railroad. And that's what he thought, and so he just resigned from the railroad altogether. So the process of getting informed consent actually involves looking at Section C even before you look at Section B. The first thing you have to ask yourself, if there's a significant risk, is can I even ask the client for consent. Or if the client says, I want to agree, can you even allow them to agree? Not if you're, if the clients are involved in a claim against each other, nor, and under this circumstance is rendering it reasonably unlikely. If you look at the comments, I at least say this is both a subjective and objective test. You, the lawyer, must in fact believe that you can provide adequate representation if there are two clients at the same time to both of them, and that decision has to be objectively reasonable, that a disinterested lawyer looking at the situation would say, yes, I think you can provide adequate representation. I get called in to be an expert witness on occasion, and it's often this is what I'm asked to testify to. I'm asked to come in as an objective lawyer with no stakes, look at the situation and say, was it objectively reasonable to ask the clients for consent? And a number of occasions, the courts have said, even though you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and got the client to sign, it was not, you really couldn't adequately represent both parties. But if it's permissible, then you have to do 1, 2, 3. And after you've done 1, 2, 3, then you have to get informed consent confirmed in writing. It's intentionally difficult. I would say, when in doubt, don't. Be cautious about seeing that there's a significant risk. If you're in any doubt, assume there is a significant risk because someone else is going to come and look at it behind you. And you don't want the client to feel you're disloyal. The thing is that if there's not a significant risk, you don't have to consult with the client. But that's a dangerous thing to do. You decide in your own mind, oh, no, I can represent both of these people. And you'll see in the comments, what's particularly sticky is if the two clients are not in litigation against each other, but they have competing economic interests. Nobody in their right mind would think you could simultaneously have Coca-Cola and Pepsi as clients, right? And if you were representing Pepsi, you wouldn't begin to take a case for Coca-Cola without talking to Pepsi first, right? So err on the side of consulting with the client and err on the side of when in doubt, don't. What's difficult about it is it usually means giving up money. And as I think I've said before, and as we talked about in terms of heroism and courage last week, it's when there's some sacrifice to your self-interest that acting ethically means something. And in the conflict of interest context, it means you have to be willing either to forego business or perhaps even to give up an existing client because you can't meet the obligations of loyalty. Questions? Okay, so we're going to take this to the next level. In a moment, we're going to talk about the OPM case, which I think you will see brings out lots of the 1.7 issues. It also probably gets you to exercise your muscles around the duty of confidentiality, but it also involves the special situation that of representing an organization as a client, which is Rule 1.13. So let's go back to the quiz, and now we're going to look at the ones you saw in advance. Pretty close. I'm going to start the timer. Everybody responded. That's right. You'd be really angry at me, wouldn't you, if I said, well, let's talk about it. That is absolutely right. D is right. And because A, B, and C are actually all true, I hope that you found the case a little bit startling when you read it. I can guarantee you that the doctors found it startling. But despite the fact that Danforth was one of the original incorporators of the company, was the main contact between the law firm and the company, and provided lots of financial information to the law firm, which would be useful to the person that was suing the doctor. There was no basis for disqualifying the law firm because the law firm never had an attorney-client relationship with the doctor, always representing the corporate entity. So it's a very nice way to really think about how bright the line is between representing a corporate entity and representing the constituents of the corporate entity. When you think back about it, if you're the lawyer who incorporates MRIGM and represents it, you would be well advised to be constantly explaining to the doctors that even though they think you're their lawyer, you're not. You only represent the corporate entity. Responses. Hey, you're all right again. How satisfying that is. Once again, a very surprising result for the attorney, don't you think? Very bad result for the attorney, because if you look at the very end of the decision. Maybe a little hard to read at the bottom. If it's determined that the lawyer wrongfully disbursed the proceeds to the sole owner of the company, the creditor can get from the attorney all the money that he disbursed to the sole stockholder. That's a pretty bad piece of news for Noreen. And once again, it shows the dangers, particularly of a corporation that has one owner, who's also the president, of mistaking the person for the company. And then the last of the questions you saw in advance, which I suppose would be nice if I displayed it for you, wouldn't it? Close. 28 responses. Well, I think that's enough of a variance. A third of you thought B was the right answer, and 64 of you thought none of the above. So I'll let the firms talk. Okay, I'm about to start the timer. Timer's running. Two people either haven't jumped in the water or think they haven't, It doesn't think so. Okay. You're welcome.
I got you.
Okay. Managing partner, any unanimity in your firm? Okay. I'll start with Brilliant Brunettes.
Okay, we picked B.
B?
Yes.
It's only 18%. Come on. Why B?
Because we were going off of C2 of Rule 113, which says permit such disclosure, but only if and to the extent the lawyer reasonably is necessary to prevent substantial injury to the organization. So we thought that meant that, like, the necessary condition that must be met is that you have to believe that it's necessary to prevent substantial injury.
And the Brilliant Brunettes are right, folks. Okay. So 1.6 exception there.
Reasonably believes.
Yeah.
So it's not necessary to prevent substantial harm.
Well, if it's necessary, you certainly permit it. Reasonably believes is a slightly lower standard, right?
Right. So this is saying that it's a requirement.
The question.
Which of the following is a necessary condition?
Well, that's interesting.
So it's
so
not
that's
a
why
necessary
you...
condition that it be necessary to prevent substantial injury. It's a necessary condition that he reasonably believes it's necessary to prevent substantial injury.
Okay. It's interesting interpretation.
Can we probably appeal like right now?
Yeah. No.
Can we all join?
Appeals have to be in writing. Appeals have to be in writing.
Like, do our appeal right now?
No. 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 I will tell you that previously A and C were very frequently selected. Why did people pick those, do you think? Anybody? Yeah.
Because they were a part of the proposals in 2003.
Right. And in fact, they're carried forward in the ABA version of 1.6, which, of course, you all looked at carefully previously. But let's take a quick look at it. Okay, so in 2002, that's what the ABA version of 1.6 looked like. Okay? And there was no exception that gave a lawyer discretion to disclose information when the lawyer reasonably believed that his services had been used to perpetuate a fraud or something like that. Even though, as you saw from the materials, that was an amendment that had been proposed to the House of Delegates and rejected by the House of Delegates. Then, Enron hit. Okay? Almost exactly when the House of Delegates rejected things. Sarbanes-Oxley was passed. And 1 year later, the House revisited the question. And they made a number of changes. One of the changes they made was to 1.6. To add these exceptions. which were intended to be the tempting wrong answers to this quiz question. The reason they're the wrong answer is they're not exceptions under 1.13, the organization as client. They're exceptions under 1.6. Then also was added to 1.13 these provisions, whistleblowing provisions. It's kind of an odd exception to 1.6 if you think about who's the client, because this exception is only applies when disclosing the information benefits the client. If you as the lawyer think that the client, the organization itself, is reasonably certain to be injured by the actions typically of its officers or employees, and you've talked about it internally, there's this reporting up requirement, and still the company is either allowing the action to take place or they're not rectifying the action, then you have the discretion, if you reasonably believe, to disclose the information, even if it otherwise would be protected by 1.6, but only to the extent you reasonably believe necessary to prevent substantial injury to the organization. In contrast, the exceptions that were added in 2003 to 1.6 are to protect other people from your client. Okay? These are to prevent the client from doing things that will injure other people. Whereas 1.13 is to protect the organization against being harmed by typically its officers or employees. And I will be interested to read the appeal that anybody may file to D. Okay, now we're going to take a look at the OPM case. And what I'm going to do is show you a video, like you saw for the Simon case, of people in a prior semester doing this exercise with somebody playing the CEO and somebody playing the lawyer. And I'm just going to show you the first couple of, the very beginning of the simulation. This is great.
Hey. Hello, Mallory.
Hey, how are you doing?
This is pretty unexpected. I have a meeting to go to in about 15 minutes, so what's on your mind?
I know. I'm sorry to barge in like this, but since you don't have much time, I'll just get right to the point. Did you get a letter from Clifton, John Clifton, lately?
Okay. You are now going to select a member of your firm to role play what you would do in response to that question if you were sitting right here.
Just that question.
Just that question. You need to hear it again?
No.
It's pretty.
And this guy's your client, right? Okay.
Well, this is Goodman. This is Myron Goodman. This is Andrew Reinhardt. Goodman has showed up without an appointment. He's the CEO of OPM, privately held corporation, has two stockholders, he's one of them, and he's the CEO. You're Reinhardt, you just got a memo from the chief fiscal officer, John Clifton.
Hey. Hello, Mallory.
Hey, how are you doing?
This is pretty unexpected. I have a meeting to go to in about 15 minutes, so what's on your mind?
I know, I'm sorry to barge in like this, but since you don't have much time, I'll just get right to the point. Did you get a letter from Clifton, John Clifton, lately?
Go for it. Here you go.
Thank you. I feel like... think I would simply state that I did receive a letter. I haven't had time to thoroughly examine it yet, but it did allege many instances of fraud on behalf of you operating on behalf of your company.
You want to be your guy? Sounds good.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, the thing is, Clifton serves at the pleasure of Goodman. So, I mean, I feel like that he's the highest authority in the company.
Right.
So he is in this place. Like, the confidentiality is within him as the CEO.
What are we operating at? 1.6.
The confidentiality.
I like what you said, that you had to tell him that you received a letter.
Look, I gotta go in 10 minutes. You just popped into my office and I just did receive this letter.
Haven't had a chance to read it.
$5 million fraud.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I'm sure we can hash all that
that's
out.
Thing, yeah, that's what I do think. You have to be, you know, basic. So, yes, the letter, I received a letter, it was a bit disturbing. It's alleging numerous counts of fraud on behalf of you and your company. But unfortunately, I couldn't have this discussion with you right now. I'd like to arrange an appointment further to where we can sit down and look at these allegations one at a time and discuss them because they are very concerning.
I think that's good.
I'm not, you know, if I have 10 minutes, I'm certainly not going to be like, well, sure. GRPC 1.3 states that.
Yeah.
And bear with me here.
Yeah. I'll write up that appeal, y'all.
We already wrote the first one.
Huh?
B was correct on that last one?
Yeah.
B was incorrect.
Yeah. 82% said D.
So the reasonably believes didn't matter.
Reasonably necessary wasn't.
Reasonably necessary. No, reasonably believes. So the question asked what was necessary, and then the entry was like, if he originally believes that this is happening, then that. So, but you already drafted the first appeal, so you can't. We're gonna have to give you two if you draft the second appeal.
Well, I mean, there's
or 1.5 or whatever
just
it is.
Tell me, Buck, if you'll send me like.
Sure.
Well, I'm just saying like.
What you think we should say? I'll write it up. I'll formally write it up. It's gonna take me 5 minutes.
Good.
All right.
That's called efficiency.
I'm not gonna argue.
Yeah, I'm like.
I'll shoot out an email or something, and, but like.
Okay, we're gonna take a look at the Teller firm. Who's the Reinhardt back there? Okay. What are the next words out of your mouth?
Is there anything you want to tell me?
I just want to look at the letter.
Okay. I did receive a letter, and actually, I am going to schedule a meeting with you and your partner.
Okay, let's jump over to defendant.
Yes, I did receive a letter from Mr. Clifton, and it contained many concerning allegations of fraud regarding you and your company, and I only have a few minutes to sit down right now, but if we could schedule a follow-up appointment, I'd like to discuss this at length with you as a personal friend and client our entire lives. I feel this should be fleshed out. We should discuss this at a better time. I got to run.
Is that that newspaper in front of you right now?
Hmm?
Is the letter of that newspaper right in front of you right now?
This is what you handed out.
for firm. That's a demo?
No, this is firm. Firm.
Peer reviewed.
The letter's on my computer.
Okay, can I take a look at it right now? Just pass your monitor.
I really have only 9 minutes now.
Ellen's password protected, and you forgot the password.
Yeah, I really. We're cutting it close. My clock's a little slow.
I can take it with me when I leave.
Do what?
Can you have your girl copy and give it to you?
Oof. Well, no, I can't do that. That's a private communication.
Okay.
I am.
Okay, what you gonna say?
Yes. Can you tell me about what's going on? Fill me in.
Well, I don't know what the hell Clifton's up to. I can't tell you anything. I know what's going on in his mind. Is he clever?
He told me he talked to you about some issues that he found.
Like, that's why I brushed over here. He said he sent you a letter, which I thought was very strange. So what did the letter say?
You seem distraught. I mean, it seems like you know that something's going on.
Yeah, Myron does look a little distraught with you. He's all unconvincing.
I think maybe we should schedule another meeting to where we can meet with Mr. Weissman, and you and the three of us can talk about this and see if maybe he knows anything more of what's going on.
I guess. What should be a copy letter?
I can't give you a copy of the letter. It's private communication.
Okay. And this, right heart. What are you going to say?
Myron, why do you think I have a letter?
Hell if I know. Seems totally bizarre to me.
Oh, well, then that sounds great. I mean, if you're totally flabbergasted about why I have some serious letter. Okay, well then, I mean, I'm confused why you think I would have a letter also.
Wait a minute. You did get a letter from Clifton?
I'm not saying whether I did or didn't. Why do you think I did?
Really, for that. For that. Okay.
Why do you ask? Why do you ask?
Because I want to know.
Are you concerned? yes, I did receive a letter.
This is right heart over here. So, because you're the last one to chime in.
Yes, I did.
What did it say?
I'm not privileged. I'm not. I think that we need to have a meeting to discuss this with Bob and yourself before we go any further today.
Okay. Well, let's see what your predecessor did under these circumstances.
Hold it.
What?
So it's pretty unexpected. I have a meeting to go to in about 15 minutes, so what's on your mind?
I know, I'm sorry to barge in like this, but since you don't have much time, I'll just get right to the point. Did you get a letter from Clifton, John Clifton, lately?
What are you pertaining to? What you?
I mean, pertaining to the business. It would have been within the last few days if you got one. I was talking to him, and he didn't really tell me what he was talking about, but he did make mention of the fact that he might send you a letter, and I was wondering if he did, because if he did, I need to talk to you about it. And he wouldn't really talk to me, which kind of irritated me because it has to do with the business. But
I did receive a letter. What was your concerns about? What was your concerns about communications between me and CFO?
Well, there were some issues there that he had briefly alluded to, but he didn't get into the details about some of our contracts and within the company over at OPM, and I'm wondering what was said in that letter. Obviously, if it concerns the company, then it's something that I need to know about.
Well, as you know, you guys did contact me to be an attorney for the company.
Yeah.
So as far as that letter is concerned, I wouldn't be able to divulge to you what was exactly in the letter. It's basically a confidential.
I know, but Morty and I are the only two. He's just an employee. We own the company.
Yeah.
And obviously you're on the board too. I mean, if there's stuff going on within the company, we need to know about it. I don't really appreciate Clifton kind of going behind my back and sending this letter to you and not even telling me what he wrote to you about.
Yeah, and I understand that. But at the same time, my representation of the company doesn't necessarily extend to employees or agents of the company unless I get consent from the...
Well, you have my consent as a member and have on the country to go ahead and reveal to me what that letter said, because if there's problems, then we need to work on fixing them and get to the bottom of it, and I can't really do that unless I know. You know, I don't know why I've been excluded here on this information.
Well, it's part. I mean, you've been excluded because your interests could be like adverse to the company, and there's some things that have happened that could maybe lead to litigation, and I can't give you information that was in that letter.
Well, if Clifton, thing is, he. How do you know what's in that letter is accurate? How do you know it's not just mistakes and things that he saw that are incomplete? He didn't have all the information, since he really wouldn't talk to me all that much about it. I mean, you're my personal attorney too. We've been friends for a long time, and I'm here talking to you now as my personal attorney, and possibly to ask you for some advice about what I should do next.
But to avoid further conflicts of interest, you'll probably have to get an outside attorney. Being as this first communication was given to me from the company, and now you've come in and you could possibly be, you know, adverse to the company's interests. So I can't represent both of you.
But we've been friends for so. I mean, you're. The reason why you're where you're at now in the law firm is because of our company, and now you're telling me that I have to go someplace else and get another lawyer after all these years. We've been friends for, 10 years now?
Yeah.
10 years in 1 minute. Can you tell me anything about the letter? Obviously, it's not anything good. Did it have to do with some leases that we executed in a computer leasing that we're doing?
No, I can't really say. I can't really give you any information on whether the letter was good or bad or what was contained in the letter. It's the same thing if somebody, you know, just off the street just came into my office and asked for some of your records or some communication that you sent to me.
No, it's not the same thing, because I'm half owner of the company, and this has to do with the company.
You know, the company itself is an entity by itself, and I have to protect.
I know, but you, the company's not going to come in here and sit down at a table. It's going to be one that's going to be doing that. And it's me now. I am the company.
Yeah, but if, say something happens to the company, say, and you guys had creditors coming after you, they would be the persons that would be sitting in my office asking me why I had given you information. So it's not just really the company itself, it's really the interest of everyone. I mean, the interest of everyone who has an interest in the company is who I'm protecting.
Well, who are those people, though?
You know, your creditors, your employees, Morty.
So what you're saying is, are you still representing the company as its attorney and not me personally?
Yes, I'm representing the company.
So if I start telling you things that are personal, then I'm basically... there's no way you can... Because if I told you anything, I wouldn't want you to be telling anybody else.
Yes.
It would just have to be between me and you.
Yes, and that's why I can't represent both of you, because there's that conflict of interest there.
So whatever, I guess what was in that letter was pretty bad.
Yes. It might, I mean, this is an answer. And being that you guys are inside the company, you guys are going to be able to talk about it if it's necessary.
Have you already talked to Morty about this?
No.
You haven't talked to anybody else about it, except for Clifton, huh?
Well, I just received information from Clifton. That's about it.
Well, I hate that it has to end up being this way, but I appreciate your time.
It's no problem.
Sorry I bothered you.
I see.
You too.
Well, aren't you glad that it was him and not you for the last 8 minutes? Okay, so at the beginning of the next class, I'll let you know the case will certainly help you think about it's not just if you do criminal defense work that you may face some ethical challenges. But so the last minute or two we have before we wrap this up, and as I say, I'll put up the information about next week tomorrow. What would any of you done differently than he did? Yeah.
I maybe would have used the friendship to kind of smooth it out. I would still say, as the corporation's attorney, I can't reveal this information. But as your friend, I would advise you to seek outside counsel and maybe explain that to them.
Okay. And then Brett.
Am I wrong that as far as the corporation goes, he and his partner, not partner, but for lack of a better word, whatever, co-owner, are the company? I mean, I don't really understand. I'm like him, where he says I am the company. Is that not correct? I mean,
it's not correct.
Okay.
And that's why I gave you the two cases that we did the quizzes on. Like the doctors that got together for the company in Minnesota, and even more, the fuel case, where you had one person who sold stockholders in that company. But the lawyer treated him as identical company, he owned all the stock, the court said, wait a minute, you have two clients, you have a corporation, which in that case was insolvent. And with an insolvent corporation, the corporation's duties are not necessarily first to its stockholders. Its duties are probably first to its creditors. The stockholders come in later.
Right, but who is
going to
sit down at the table then and he and the other guy stopped it?
Well, this is, of course, we're not a closely held corporation, of course. This is a particularly sticky situation. So there's the board of directors, right? So who's on the board of directors anyway?
He is.
That's right, there's three people on the board of directors, two stockholders and the company attorney. And that used to be fairly common. It's much less common now. So Reinhard could not be more conflicted. Okay? So he has a long-standing personal friendship with Goodman. He he has an attorney, the firm has a personal attorney-client relationship with Quinton. They do their taxes, their charitable gifts. So he has an attorney-client relationship with Quinton as an individual and the other owner. He has an attorney-client relationship with the corporation, but he also has a fiduciary duty to the member of the board of directors. And in fact, in a situation like this, you look to the board, to the disinterested members of the board of directors, which ironically is me. Okay, but so yeah, but that doesn't. So he really does have to be clear that the corporation is the client and not the two owners of the corporation who are the officers. Yeah, Brett.
I just want to say right up front, you know, remember that I represent the company. I don't represent you on a personal level. So if any matters between you and the company, I have to side with the company.
He does.
Remember also that with any issues, because he clearly knows it's in that letter. Also remember that any issues.
Does it?
It seems quite apparent that he's nervous the way he's sitting.
Well, he knows that it's maybe not something new.
Yeah, exactly. And so any information that he shares with me is not held up by confidentiality, that he should seek an outside attorney, which I'm telling him as both a close friend and as the lawyer of this company.
Okay, we're going to come back, and probably the first thing we're going to do next week is revisit the question of what you say to Goodman when he says, did you get a letter? All right?
Yeah.
Is it cool if I email it to you tomorrow morning?
Do what?
Is it cool if I email it to you tomorrow morning?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine.
Yeah.
God, dude, I need that. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, that's me at all.
So.
Okay, cool.